Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our theme, American Interventionism, how the United States interferes in the outcome of elections and promotes regime change around the world. Why are they allowed to get away with it? My guest from Pittsburgh is Professor Dan Kovalik, K-O-V-A-L-I-K. Dan is a human rights and labor justice attorney, a peace activist, an adjunct professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His work is focused on Latin America. He has worked on tort cases against Coca-Cola, Drummond Company, and Occidental Petroleum over human rights abuses in Colombia. Christian Science Monitor named him as one of America's most prominent defenders of Colombian workers under threat of assassination, which earned him a Project Censored Award. Dan also works as the Senior General Counsel for the United Steelworkers Union. He's a graduate of Columbia University Law School. He contributes frequently to Counterpunch, Telesur, Huffington Post, and other sites. He's published books on the scapegoating of Russia and the United States' efforts to overthrow the Iranian government. His most recent book is The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Nice to have you with us today, Dan.
Thank you, Gary. Glad to be back.
Right now, as we speak, special forces are assembling in Puerto Rico. Also today, just an hour ago, Brazil's vice president said the United States will not be allowed to use its territory to invade Venezuela. You have right now the entirety of the American media, from the left to the right, with the exception of some of the more progressive sites that actually take the time to do their homework and know the truth, that Venezuela, Maduro, its president, pose no threat to anyone, least off their own citizens. We've been led to believe by the very selective editing of the news that we receive that Venezuelans are dying, committing suicide, eating grass, starving to death, all because of socialism. This is coming from a country that socializes all major corporations, and we the people pay for that, and yet they're able to keep their profits under their own corporate principles. This is from a country that has been engaged in 69 separate coup attempts or supportive regime change against the election of people that would not be in alignment with America's hegemonic principles. We've been lied to, manipulated. Before we get to you, I want to share something with one of the world's greatest journalists and documentarians, John Pilger, from Countercurrents. The war on Venezuela is built on lies. Quote, traveling with Hugo Chavez, I soon understood the threat of Venezuela. At a farming cooperative in Lara State, people waited patiently and with good humor in the heat. Jugs of water and melon juice were placed around. A guitar was playing. A woman stood and sang with a husky voice. What did her words say, I ask? They are very proud, was the reply. The applause for her merged with the arrival of Chavez. Under one arm, he carried a satchel bursting with books. He wore a big red shirt and greeted people by name, stopping to listen. What struck me was his capacity to listen. But now he read. For almost 2 hours, he read into the microphone from the stack of books beside him. Orwell, Dickens, Tolstoy, Zola, Hemingway, Chomsky. A page here, a line or two there. People clapped and whistled as he moved from one author to another. Then farmers took the microphone and told him what they knew and what they needed. One ancient face carved, it would seem, from a nearby banyan, made a long critical speech on the subject of irrigation. Chavez took notes. Wine is grown here, a dark type of grape, John said. He likes red wine, Chavez told the cheering, whistling audience. Watching Chavez made sense because what he promised, he delivered. From that, we understand something that is not told in the American media. Chavez was the hero for the working class and the poor. He brought schools where there were none, food where there were empty stomachs, and he brought cooperatives, medical cooperatives, clinics, where before, with all of its wealth and its aristocracy, they held in these people in utter disdain. They deprived them even the basics. As a result, Hugo Chavez won every single election he was in. And now Maduro, his replacement, is under attack. This is from Craig Murray, just one page, The Vultures of Caracas. We're frequently told that people in Venezuela have no food, clothing, or toilet paper, and that popular discontent with the left-wing government is driven by real hunger. There are elements of truth in this story, though the causes of economic dislocation are far more complex than the media would have us believe. But I ask you to look at this photo of supporters of CIA poster boy of the West, unelected president, taken at a rally in Caracas 2 days ago and published yesterday in security services, including The Guardian. Please take a really close look at the photo. Blow it up as big as you can. Scan individual people in the crowd, one by one. These are not the poor. These are not the starving. As it chances, I have a great deal of life experience working amongst the seriously deprived, hungry, and despairing people. I know the gaunt face of want and the desperate glances of need. Look at these supporters of this non-elected American puppet. One by one, look at them. This designer spectacle, well-coiffed, elegantly dressed, sleekly jeweled, group does not know hunger. This group does not know from want. This is the proper right-wing gathering, a gathering of the nicely off section of society. This is a group of those who have corruptly been siphoning Venezuela's great wealth for decades and who want to make sure that the paltry amount that they receive now is replaced with a gravy train flowing properly in their direction. Again, it is, in short, a group exactly the kind of people you would expect to support a CIA coup. Those manicured hands raised in the air will never throw rocks or get involved in violence unless against a peasant strapped to a chair for them. It is not this crowd which will suffer as public disorder is manipulated and directed by the CIA. These wealthy ones are immune, just as Davos serves as nothing but an annual reminder of how very poorly God aims avalanches. There is real suffering in Venezuela. The CIA is working hard to stoke violence, and the genuine poor will soon start to die, both in those egged on to riot and in the security services. But do not get them taken in by the complete nonsense that this is a popular democratic revolution. It is not. It is yet another barefaced CIA regime change coup. The forum is yours.
Well, I think, you know, it's not just even about socialism. Look, the U.S. is an empire. We have to start with that premise. We have anywhere between 800 and 1,000 bases around the world, which gives, you know, to put it into some perspective, the Great Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, had about 33 bases. The Great British Empire had about 36 bases. We have 800 to 1,000 bases. The United States began as a colony, but it saw itself as having the God-given right to have a nation from sea to shining sea. It got rid of the peoples who lived there when we got here. And it decided very early on that it was, again, allowed to go even beyond the mainland United States to other islands and to other nations to take them over. And certainly since World War II, that sort of hegemonic quest has only accelerated, many times in the name of fighting communism or socialism. But in the end, it's been about monopolizing the world's resources and the world's wealth. Right after World War II, the U.S. having about 5% of the world's population or so, controlled 50% of its resources. And while it would be impossible to hold on to that, you know, percentage of resources forever, the U.S. still, with under 6% of the world's population, controls 25% of its resources. And so this is all about trying to keep the world safe for maximum penetration by the U.S. of the world's resources. And when we talk about Venezuela, of course, we're talking about primarily oil, Venezuela having the largest oil reserves on Earth. Also huge gold reserves and coltan reserves and diamond reserves. And so ever since Hugo Chavez was elected president in 1998, and he was elected president, and I emphasize that because many times you'll hear in the press that somehow he came to power through a coup or whatnot. The U.S. has been intent on getting rid of him. And why? Because Hugo Chavez and his successor, Nicolas Maduro, decided that they wanted to use Venezuela's oil reserves for the people and not for the oligarchs and not for the United States. Well, that's just unacceptable. That's what's unacceptable here. And so we see right now the U.S. thinks it smells blood in the water, and it thinks it can topple the Chavista government, the Bolivarian government in Venezuela, and it's moving to do that. And it's very clear. John Bolton's been very open about the fact that he is planning to take over Venezuela's oil. So I think that's what this is about, primarily. And of course, secondarily, it is about destroying a good example so that other countries will not dare to do the same thing that Venezuela has done with its resources.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. So RT reported today that the U.S. has sent special operation forces to Puerto Rico, as I mentioned at the opening of the program, in preparation for a potential military invasion. Mind you, this is a sovereign nation, and Trump and his administration and members of both parties have been threatening this. Even the so-called liberal media is on board to remove Maduro and raise Guaido to the presidency. Someone who never officially ran for office, and after having people such as Professor Francis Boyle, Professor William Robinson, and Greg Palast on this show recently to try to set the record straight, I must say I'm dumbfounded at the lies all the mainstream media, especially the New York Times. I don't think they're capable of telling the truth about anything today except maybe a baseball score. They're spewing forth nothing but propaganda lies, like they did with Judah Miller to get us into Iraq, and nobody at the Times was held accountable. Colin Powell was not held accountable. Everybody lied. A million people died. $6 trillion was spent. Thousands of Americans died. Tens of thousands injured, and not a single person was held accountable. Wow. I'll recall it was Jimmy Carter who stated that during the last election of Chavez, it was perhaps the fairest election in recent world history, even though I do not regard Maduro as a suitable president. He is far weaker than his predecessor and not as savvy as a politician. He was democratically elected, and all the evidence I can find indicates the majority of Venezuelans are behind him. And we are seeing some of the most ridiculous operations underway by Maduro's opponents and backed fully by the United States. And, of course, anything we do, Great Britain, the lapdog that it is, will be right there at our tail. And nobody in the media is speaking about the hardships U.S. sanctions have had on the country since Obama levied them. And mind you, Obama has never been called out by the left for anything, for his bombings, for his killings, nothing. And so please give us your analysis of the situation unfolding in Venezuela as we speak. And aside from Venezuela's possessing, as you just mentioned, the world's largest reserves in oil and also gold, what are the other fundamental reasons why the U.S. is determined to oust Maduro?
Yes. Yes. So as you point out, yes, Great Britain is holding $1.5 billion in gold that Venezuela deposited in the Bank of England. And as you say, they're just simply not giving it back. The U.S. is freezing all the assets of Venezuela's oil company, SICO, meaning that any oil they sell now, they cannot send any of the money, the revenue back from that oil back to Venezuela. So, and these are the, you know, type of sanctions that the U.S. has been levying as of late, but it's been levying sanctions against Venezuela since 2015. And even before that, in 2014, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia colluded together to flood the market with oil, to lower oil prices, mainly to hurt Iran and Russia, but this completely devastated Venezuela, which depends on oil for about 78% of its revenue. Overnight, you might recall, oil went from something like $120 a barrel to a low of $25 a barrel. So you can imagine what that did to Venezuela's revenue. And again, this was done purposefully. So you add that to the sanctions, and you see that the U.S. has really been at war. And it is a war. It's an economic war, but it's no less a war because it's economic, against Venezuela. For some time, certainly since 2014, but even before that, because we also have to remember the U.S. backed the coup against Chavez, which lasted for a couple of days back in 2002. The U.S. supported a management strike against the oil, National Oil Company back in 2002, 2003. So the U.S. has been undermining Venezuela in various ways for many years now. And as you say, the media has not given the American people any glimpse that this has been happening. All the ills that Venezuela is suffering, economically and otherwise, are all blamed on the government there, right? We don't see any link. We're never shown the link between the sanctions and the economic woes in Venezuela. Last year alone, over $20 billion. Venezuela suffered over $20 billion in losses due to the sanctions in 1 year alone. And yet, that is never connected with the deprivations that people are enduring in that country. And that is a great failure on the part of the media not to point those things out. Meanwhile, Nicolas Maduro, and I was an election observer in May of last year in Caracas, Nicolas Maduro, in a very free and fair election, garnered over 6 million votes, 67% of the votes cast in Venezuela, meaning, one, he's the legitimate president, but two, it means that he has over 6 million people who support him, at least, right? And yet we never, ever in the mainstream press hear from one of those voices, from one of those 6 million people who support him. And as you noted earlier on in some of the opinion pieces you were reading, those 6 million people tend to be poorer people. They tend to be people of color who were ignored, who were forgotten before Chavez was elected. And when you see the competing rallies, the rallies for the opposition and the rallies for the government. You see this very easily. You see the darker-skinned poor people supporting Maduro, and you see the wealthier, lighter-skinned people opposing Maduro. And, of course, the irony here is that, you know, the so-called left in the United States would tend to at least claim to support those types of folks that are on the side of Maduro, right? And yet they're not. One, because they may not understand, because of the lack of media coverage of the situation, they don't understand that that dynamic exists. But also, they just don't understand the basic logic of U.S. intervention and imperialism, because we're so inured to it. It is so much part of our culture, so much part of our politics that people don't even question it. Certainly the media never questions it. Every war, every intervention the U.S. has been involved in has begun with a lie. You can go back to the Spanish-American War in 1898. Remember the Maine, right? The Maine, the ship that went down. We blame the Spanish. It turns out, in fact, there was probably a boiler explosion from within that brought that down. You have, of course, the Gulf of Tonkin lie, which got the U.S. deeper into Vietnam. You have the lie about weapons of mass destruction in 2003, which paved the way for the war in Iraq. You have the lie about the babies being thrown on the hospital floor in Kuwait by Iraqi soldiers in 1990 that paved the way for that war. You have in Libya the allegation that was completely ridiculous and untrue that Gaddafi was giving Viagra to his soldiers to engage in mass rape, which paved the way for the war there. Over and over we are lied to justify war. Over and over the media, including the paper of record, the New York Times, lies us into every war. And we end up realizing this once the war begins or once the war's over. Oops. What we were told happened never happened. But then we block that out and we're lied into the next war very easily. There's this incredible amnesia amongst the American people, which prevents them from opposing the next war, right? And so now we are being lied into the next war with Venezuela. We are being told that Nicolas Maduro is starving his own people, when in fact the government of Nicolas Maduro provides subsidized food to people, even though the government of Nicolas Maduro spends over 70% of the revenue it's able to bring in on social programs, even though the government of Nicolas Maduro has been building homes for the poor. Over 2.5 million homes have been built since Chavez was elected, and Nicolas Maduro continues that housing program. But this is the guy we are being told is starving his own people. In fact, it's the U.S. that's starving the Venezuelan people and then blaming them for starving. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Canada purport to give, a token amount of aid to Venezuela while they're costing the Venezuelan economy billions of dollars. It's a quite sick situation that's unfolding. And that, again, it's not just that the press is unfair about the coverage. It's that the press totally blocks out any other narrative on what's happening. And it's also that the press obsesses about Venezuela and all the problems there. If you obsessed about the problems of the United States every day, like you obsess with Venezuela's problems, you might think we need a humanitarian intervention to deal with the over 2 million people who are in jail, more people than any more jailed people than any country on earth, as an ultimate a total number and also as a percentage of the population.
Dan, let me just intervene for a moment here. If people are just tuning in, I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. My guest is Professor Dan Kovalik. We are talking about interventionism hegemony around the world, and we were just discussing one country, Venezuela. Now, Dan, I'd like you to shift gears, please, and I'd like you to talk about that all of the emphasis now is against Iran. We support Israel, an apartheid state, against Iran. We support Saudi Arabia, a terrorist state, a hostage to anything of common sense. They are one of the most barbaric countries in world history, beheading gays, beheading anyone they disagree with, the stoning people to death, lashing women who've been raped for the crime that they allowed themselves somehow to be raped. And these are the people we do business with. We should have nothing to do with this backwater regime. And it's an absolute monarchy. Kuwait, no better. United Arab Emirates, no better. Qatar, no better. And so these are the people we align with, and it's all about Iran. Well, why don't you take us back to 1953, actually 52, and under Eisenhower, later get turned over from there. It was Truman who originally was given the idea, let's do something. The CIA and the British intelligence worked together. In fact, it was the Office of Strategic Planning, and then it was the M15 who got together and started putting pressure because Mossadegh, well, I'm not going to tell the story. You tell the story of Iran and how Iran could be our partners in world peace today instead of being demonized. Also Guatemala, the Congo, Vietnam, Chile, and other Central American nations that we engaged in regime change, causing the death and disappearance and torture of a lot of people. No one knows the actual numbers. And not a single person who was responsible was held accountable. Not a single person in the media apologized. And also, during all this time, there was one legislator. We don't have any such people today in Congress, none. But we had one legislator. His name was Frank Church, who had the courage to take on the establishment, and he took on the CIA. And the CIA director at that time, Colby, acknowledged that they had 1,300 assets in the media. They controlled the major media. So it didn't stop. It only increased from there. So take us on a tour of what happens when we intervene in a country and the unintended or intended consequences of that action.
Yes, so as you know, Iran was, in fact, the first CIA coup operation. As you say, it began in 1952. And the issue was that their democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, a very gentle man, a guy who actually conducted most of his business from bed in pink satin pajamas, interestingly enough, with the support of his parliament, decided to nationalize Iran's oil industry, which at that point had been controlled and wholly owned by the British.
British Petroleum.
Right. It became known as British Petroleum, right. And moreover, Mossadegh offered to pay compensation for nationalizing that. Now, there were disagreements about how much he should give, and it was this disagreement that led to Britain wanting to overthrow Mossadegh. And interestingly, in 52, it was the Labour government that was in charge of Great Britain, and it was in itself involved in nationalizing industry in Britain. But Iran was not allowed to nationalize its own industry. And so at first, there was a run with Truman to support a coup against Iran, and he was just not of the he had no interest in a coup at that point in to help out the British oil industry. And so Churchill, though, was then elected, and he decided to make another run at the U.S., this time with Eisenhower, and to claim that somehow Mossadegh was a communist threat. And that convinced Eisenhower, and even though that wasn't true, and Eisenhower, with using the CIA, fomented violence, undermined Iran's economy, including by a blockade against Iranian oil and ended up overthrowing the government of Mohammad Mossadegh. And in his place, they put the Shah of Iran, otherwise known as a king. And so in the name of democracy, the U.S. replaced a democratic prime minister with a king. And not only that, this king, who was not very popular, was supported by something called the SAVAK, the CIA, figuring out that the Shah did not have much support, created the security apparatus known as the SAVAK, and they trained the SAVAK in Nazi torture techniques. And the Shah, with the U.S. help and with the use of the SAVAK, ruled Iran with an iron hand until 1979, when the Shah was finally overthrown in the Islamic Revolution, and, which continues to this day. In 1978, the year before the Shah was overthrown, Amnesty International concluded that Iran had the very worst human rights record on Earth. And this was the government that the U.S. was supporting, again, in the name of democracy. Who knows where Iran would be today had Mossadegh been allowed to continue, had Iran's democracy there, its secular democracy, I would know, whether it was, would be allowed to flourish. We'll never know. And as you point out, the CIA then would quickly turn its sights on Guatemala, overthrow the democratic president there, Jacobo Arbenz, because he wanted to give land to the poor, to the peasants, and he again wanted to pay for unused land to be able to do that. A lot of that unused land was owned by United Fruit Company, now Chiquita Banana, who was upset by this. And by the way, the Dulles brothers, Alan and John Dulles, the head of the CIA and the Secretary of State, respectively, both had interest in United Fruit, as they did, by the way, both of them in the British petroleum industry of Iran, convinced Eisenhower to overthrow Arbenz. And they did overthrow Arbenz, and they established a series, the U.S. established a series of military juntas which ruled Guatemala for decades, and which killed around 200,000 people, mostly Mayan Indians, in what is now known as a genocide. And we can go on and on, but this is the type of game the U.S. has been playing for many years, and what we're seeing in Venezuela is a repeat of what we saw in Iran, and what we saw in Guatemala, and what we saw in Chile in 1973 when the U.S. overthrew a democratically elected president and put in place a fascist general, Augusto Pinochet. And so people need to know this. They need to know that the U.S., despite claiming to support democracy, rarely does. The U.S., in fact, supports at this present moment 73% of the world's dictatorships. And, in fact, as Eduardo Galeano, the great Uruguayan writer who wrote Open Veins of Latin America, has correctly pointed out, every time the U.S. Attempts to save another country, it turns it either into an insane asylum or a cemetery. And unless we know that history, we're going to continue to march forward with these interventions, which are invariably disastrous.
Well, Dan, it's just common sense and reason that if you're in a position of power, if your corporate interests align with those who are oligarchs in a country, and you can use the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, you can use different organizations and Astro Group to get power, get a position in that country like United Fruit did, then you're going to take advantage of it. And unfortunately, the American media is never the first to ring the alarm that something is amiss, nor are they there to hold people accountable if those people who are accountable, like Obama and Clinton's, are part of their group, inner group. So that doesn't surprise me. I see nothing changing. What I'm concerned with right now is in Latin America, you have a radical turn toward the right. Apparently, all the newly elected Latin American presidents are either corporatist or heavily aligned with free market capital. Bolsonaro in Brazil is especially disturbing. He is like a modern-day Mussolini, and he's proud of it. All of these people are determined to build closer relations with the United States. So do you observe any American plot behind this wave of change, and how much of these efforts might be related to successful inroads China has been making in Latin American nations? And also, you know what the giant issue behind all this is in Latin America, also in Southeast Asia? That global warming is the largest, not just existential, people should look up the meaning of existential, but the most present immediate threat to all of our lives and the future species in the world. When you come to one of the largest rainforests in the world, one of the two largest, and that is the Amazon, it's called the lungs of the planet. It traps carbon and releases good oxygen. But now the new president, Bolsonaro, is destroying it. He's opened it up for privatization, and now you're going to see it is estimated up to 50% of the entire Amazon will be forested. Trees taken down, genetically engineered soybeans put in its place, or cattle raising. So that means that we're going to have a major contribution to global warming. It's going to get hotter no matter what we do because of that alone. And yet, nothing in any of these right-wing countries is dealing with the environment. We're talking about now human rights and equality in these countries. But behind that equality in human rights and respect for the rule of law, which doesn't exist anywhere in South and Central America or Mexico and the United States, is you have the environment. And with right-wing regimes taking over, you're going to see massive increases in carbon dioxide, methane use in China. And just as an example, I'll tell you how stupid I'm going to deal with this on my program tomorrow. You know, this, well, we're going to do everything in the next 10 years to keep the world from ending. No, you're not going to do anything in the next 10 years because you haven't thought anything out. Nothing has been planned. I will talk about what could be done realistically, but just imagine this. What do you think the largest city in the world is right now by population?
I would guess maybe Sao Paulo or Rio de Janeiro.
No. Almost double that, you've got Tokyo, almost 40 million people in a relatively small area. Do you know that China is now building the largest city in the world? Do you know how many people they plan to have live there? Over 400 million people in one city. They currently have the first of three provinces brought together by high rail and a commercial belt that connects it all with the manufacturing and distribution and residential, all interrelated, and it will have 140 million people. 140 million people, that's more than the entire population of Russia living in one city. Or put another way, that's six times the size of Tokyo. So all these people who seem to say they know the future, you're going to have the highest, fastest increase in a post-industrialized world, which has caused a 1% increase in Celsius from the last 150 years. You're going to have that in the next 5 years to 10 years. This complex will be done within 10 years. There's no way in the world you're going to control global warming. We're going to go into tipping points starting next year. And 1 year after next, we're going to have one positive feedback loop or negative feedback loop per year. You're going to have so much of the planet in absolute constant crisis. Just this week, Australia had the hottest day. It had the, in its history, thousands of people affected. You have one of the largest cities in the world in India running out of water. They say they have 1 year to go. Cape Town has no water. has run out of water. Cape Town, 4 million people out of water. In India, it's 16 million people running out of water. Those are real threats with real consequences. But beyond that, the body politic refuses to acknowledge it, refuses to divert any money or resources to correct it. And now you have these fascists like Trump, and supported by our central intelligence agencies and our State Department, that don't give a damn about anything or anyone but themselves. These are the most selfish.
No, I don't think you're wrong, and actually I'll see you and raise you one. I think, and it's interesting, that, well, let me say a few things, just on a couple of things you mentioned. So first of all, you're correct that the new president of Brazil, Bolsonaro, he even ran on a platform that he was going to open up the rainforest to exploitation, and he was willing to take on the native populations there to do it. And he is doing just that now. He is attacking the Native American populations to open up the rainforest, as you said, the lungs of the world, to maximum exploitation. But how was Bolsonaro elected? And this is very important to point out to people. He was elected because the most popular politician in Brazil, Lula da Silva, is rotting in jail. Lula da Silva would have won that election with 80% of the vote. We know this because of the polls. But he was rotting in jail. And why? Because the U.S. Justice Department worked with the Brazilian Justice Department to put him in jail based on bogus charges. Okay, so the U.S. paved the way for Bolsonaro. We have to point that out. So the right-wing shift we're seeing in Latin America is largely made in the U.S., which has been country after country involved in such legal coups. That's what they call them, legal coups, using criminal processes to oust presidents and then put in leaders that the U.S. Likes. So that's important to point out. So, but another thing, again, moving on to your issue of global warming and the indifference that, again, the ruling class has for global warming. Here's what I believe, and I think it was very interesting and very telling that this Richard Branson was part of this charade in at the Colombian-Venezuelan border with this concert, which was, he claimed it was a concert for humanitarian aid. In fact, it was a concert to support the coup against Maduro. And why is that interesting? Because Branson, the billionaire Branson, one of the things that he is very deeply involved in is his own civilian space program. He's flying, if you have enough money, millions of dollars, you can fly one of his spaceships in outer space. And why is this of interest? Because, and I'm not the only one saying this, there's been a number of interesting articles about this, that there are, amongst the super wealthy, they have decided that the world is finished, that it is beyond reclamation because of global warming and other environmental issues, and so that now they are developing their own escape plan to get out of the earth. Now, some, by the way, are decided they could move to New Zealand, and somehow New Zealand is more weatherproof than other places, so some people are buying up properties there. But others, as we know, like Branson and his rich friends, just want to leave Earth. They want to go into space. They want to go to Mars. They want to populate other places, having given up on Earth. And what we see then is that amongst the ruling class and amongst many of the governments in the world, they've given up on fighting global climate change because they have decided instead they're going to do what they can to amass as much wealth as they can as quickly as possible for themselves, even if that means accelerating global warming, so they can use that wealth to escape global warming. And in some cases, as in the case of Branson and others, to escape the Earth itself. This is a very pernicious thing, but this is very real.
That's a very good idea. I would love to see Branson, the Clintons, and the Obamas, and all the powerful people in Washington and all corporate America all get on a spaceship and go to Mars. Yeah, That'd be a great idea.
In
leave
a way,
the, leave the planet for us.
The only salvation, truthfully, is probably to find a way to ground those spaceships to make sure those people have to live with the results of their own conduct. It's the only way the conduct will change, you know.
You and I both know that even the Nazis who headed the party managed to get out through the Vatican Railroad and ended up in Venezuela, Paraguay. They were safe and they were well fed the rest of their lives. Very few.
Well, many ended
Eichmann
up here
actually
too,
got
with Operation Paperclip.
That's correct.
But yeah,
just today on the media, especially the left media, we hear about we should have Maduro removed because we care about the starving children in Venezuela. That's a good idea. Why weren't you concerned over the last 4 years about the hundreds of thousands, millions of starving children in Yemen, a war
right.
that you never spoke about until you could say something in the last 3 months against Trump. But what about all the millions of children? 19 million people are starving to death in Yemen. We are blockading any humanitarian supplies. We're allowing Saudi Arabia, our ally, to block them. So don't tell me you're for the starving children of Venezuela when you're not for the starving children of Yemen. And you haven't done a single thing that I can see to help the 16.6 million hungry or what are called food-deprived children in the United States, kids going to bed hungry because their parents didn't have enough food for them, the innocents, or the 2.5 million children who leave school each day but don't have a home to go back to. So, I coined this phrase about a year ago because I was asking myself, how is it that we could have so many people graduate from colleges, 71 million people in the professional class with advanced degrees, from scientists to consultants, engineers to accountants, and yet we have the highest degree of obesity, we're running a shorter lifespan starting 3 years ago, especially in women. 25% of all women between the ages of 25 and 45 are on antipsychotic or antidepressive medications. More mothers and fathers are giving prescription drugs to their children than ever before. We have an epidemic of obesity. We're the fattest nation in the earth, on the earth per population. We have an epidemic of heart disease, dementia, Alzheimer's, inflammatory diseases, and diabetes. Nearly 1 in 3 American adults is diabetic or pre-diabetic. And yet we're supposed to be a wise nation, and the only way I could think this would happen, including 63 million people voting for Trump, but mind you, 65 million people voting for Clinton, is that you have intentionally ignorant. I call it the intentional ignorant, because if you're intentionally ignorant, then you're intentionally negligent. You don't have to pay attention to what you're not aware of, but you're not aware of it by intent. I don't want to know the truth because I may have a pang of consciousness, guilt, or remorse for doing the wrong thing, so I simply will do what I'm conditioned to do. So we don't question what we're eating, what we're drinking, what we're giving our children, the quality of our planet. People can say, yes, I'm for the planet, and then go out like the people in Washington, and go on private jets or go to Davis on private jets. This is the contradiction that I see. And the only way I can explain it is we're incapable at this time in our evolutionary process of dealing with reason because we're not spiritually connected. And don't try to associate religion with spirituality. They're not in the same universe. And so we are just disconnected. We are engaged in this almost Romanesque, the end of Rome, where the aristocrats and the powerful people spent their days in gluttony and debauchery and excess, and the others suffered. And that's what we're doing today. Would you share your thoughts on what I just said, please?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree with you. I certainly agree. In fact, I think we're probably beyond the Roman situation that you just laid out. I mean, the technology that we thought hoped would free us, you know, the internet and cell phones has just enslaved us. You know, we are, most of us, totally captive to these little computers we hold in our hands all day. And again, we thought that they would bring us more information and more liberation, but they've brought us maybe more information, but more junk information. And, you know, it relates to what you said about people being educated in college. I mean, yeah, it's true. There's more college-educated people. But they're not learning anything about their country's history, about how their country relates to the world. You know, I teach international human rights, as you know, on the law school level. So these are very educated people. And the first thing I teach them is the case of the U.S. war against Vietnam, a war that, you know, for you and I happened within our lifetimes. For them, happened very shortly before they were born. And they know nothing about it, nothing. They don't know why it happened. They don't know how the war was prosecuted. And when they learn, it blows their mind. When they learn that the U.S. dumped tons of, many tons of napalm and Agent Orange on Vietnam, that the standard operating procedure for the military was to rape Vietnamese women and girls, they are shocked because we are not taught that that's how the U.S. operates in the world. And very few people have a glimpse into that world, into that reality, and because they don't, they don't feel a need to change the trajectory of this country. And again, it's because they're not taught this in the schools on any level, for the most part. We're probably the least educated people in the world about our own country and about our own history, because it's a very inconvenient history. It goes quite against the idea that the U.S. is some beacon of democracy and freedom in the world, when in fact everything it's actually done since its birth has been largely counter to democracy and freedom.
I appreciate your insights. Hopefully those people, I believe about 10%, that's still about 35 million people, would begin to work together to challenge American intervention, protesting it, writing about it. I'd like to see more documentaries produced on it. But if we're too busy engaged in our own narcissistic activities or too squirreled away in our own men and women caves filled with hubris, then we will stay ignorant of what is happening around the world in our name, and those in power will only collect more of it. Personally, it is my personal view, and I take full responsibility for what I'm saying. I believe America now is a full-fledged police state, providing us only with enough freedoms, as long as those freedoms do not in any way criticize or jeopardize or threaten the status quo, we're allowed to engage them. The moment we speak up, the moment we step out, the moment we declare that we have a right and an obligation, moral obligation, to challenge injustice, we then will be the target of that statement. And then we'll see those people going to jail who uncovered corruption. And those people they uncovered who were corrupt, maintaining the power with a smirk and a wink. They control the judiciary, the clowns we call our Supreme Court, the dysfunctional two bodies that we call the House and the Senate, and the deplorable stench that you must turn away from looking even in the direction of the White House because of how bad it is. Those are my thoughts. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, yes, I certainly think, I mean, I agree with you that we're becoming a nation that is not free, you know, that is... Well, it certainly already is a nation that is the most ideologized country that's ever existed, where people are most kept from the truth by a very sophisticated press and media system, which is designed to prevent you from understanding the truth, especially as it relates to U.S. Foreign policy. But still, that truth, to end on a positive note, that truth is discoverable. And people have to go out of their way to discover it, and they need to resist, and they need to build a peace movement that will end these interventions around the world, not only for the benefit of the people we're intervening against, but for our own good. We can't continue to spend trillions of dollars on wars that do nothing but destroy, while our own infrastructure decays, while people go to bed hungry in this country, while people do not have health care. And you can't have those things. You can't have health care. You can't have food. You can't have an infrastructure when all your money's going out the door on these wars. And until people link those issues, we're going to continue to suffer these issues and these problems.
Dan, I agree. The only thing I would add to what you just said is, and before we have a peace movement, we have to have a truth movement. You're only going to be enraged enough to engage into a peace movement when you know you've been lied to and know what the real truth is. Thank you for all your good work of bringing us the truth. Gan Kovalik, professor down in Pennsylvania, University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and one of America's leading peace activists and human rights attorneys. We appreciate your input. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. This is Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.